Silence is commanded.
Please be seated. We're calling our third case today, 04-AP-487, Dale Rebernick v. Warsaw General Insurance Company. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Rebernick is Attorney Ogershot. Did I pronounce that correctly? Thank you, Counsel. You may proceed.
Court, Counsel. Again, my name is Tom Ogerchuk, and I represent Dale and Sandy Rebernick, who are the plaintiffs in this action. We're before the court today discussing the applicability of one section of Section 632.32 umbrella policies. As a little background of what occurred in the case, the accident occurred June of 2001. Mr. Rebernick was injured, was on a riding mower, was struck by a car that had gone off the road and hit him in a median as he was cutting grass. He was injured in the accident. The driver of the car, Denelius Hurd, had the state minimum insurance, $25,000. Mr. Rebernick also had a policy of insurance through American Family Insurance. He had an underlying policy which had underinsured motorist limits of $100,000. That part of the case settled with American Family shortly after the accident also. In addition, approximately 1 month prior to the accident, Mr. and Mrs. Rebernick purchased through their agent a second policy of insurance with American Family, and this was an excess policy of insurance. It covered, obviously, over and above their homeowners and their auto policies, and it was a $1 million umbrella policy. That policy of insurance was not endorsed and did not have a UIM endorsement for underinsured motorist coverage.
What did it cover then?
It would have covered his liability. It would have protected him in the event that he was found liable, up to $100,000 on his primary, obviously, and then $1 million in umbrella coverage. But it would not have covered him for either uninsured or underinsured.
Well, what is the normal, or is there a expectation with umbrella coverage? What is the expectation?
To the consumer?
Yes, sir.
I don't think there is necessarily an expectation. It depends on the individual consumer. Some consumers, I think, would want to purchase umbrella cover or UIM coverage or UM coverage in their umbrella. Some insurers don't offer it in umbrella policies. I don't think we can say that there's an expectation of what the consumer would want to do. I think the critical focus in this case is what the duty of the insurer is with regard to education, with regard to notifying the consumer about what they can purchase through this policy.
Why wouldn't the expectation of the reasonable insured be that when I put that umbrella up, all that rain is going to stay off me, all that risk. So I don't know always what I have as primary, and I might not always know what I have as umbrella, but I just know that umbrella takes care of my risk. Well, that's perhaps too simplistic.
Well, I think, and it's an argument I made in the briefs, to the extent that what the Rebernicks had done a month before was, as you said, they put up the umbrella. And they were doing a good thing. They were doing a responsible thing, which was purchasing good insurance, purchasing very adequate insurance. I think an expectation could be made that if a consumer is going to take that step, if they're going to spend their money to get good coverage, to purchase an umbrella, they may have also wanted to not only protect their assets, but protect themselves, because as we all know, unfortunately, there are a lot of people out there that have either no or inadequate insurance.
I mean, protecting yourself is protecting your assets.
Absolutely. And the ability to work, to earn a living, you're protecting yourself. But unfortunately, not all consumers are savvy. Not all consumers are going to know the intricacies of what insurance covers or what different types of insurance there are. So that's why the state legislature enacted 632.32-4M in 1995. And that provision of the statutes doesn't require UIM coverage? Does it mandate that insurers write it, especially in umbrella policies? It doesn't do that, and we're not arguing that it does. What it does mandate is that insurers educate the public. When they purchase a policy of insurance, and they didn't restrict it to underlying policies or primary policies, when a consumer purchases a policy of insurance, the state legislature said to the insurance company, let the individual know what their rights are, what type of coverage they can buy, because we want people to have good insurance. We want, if you have the expectation, like the Rubernicks, of putting on this umbrella, if getting good, adequate coverage, what other coverages can you get? And if the insurer chooses not to offer UIM coverage in an umbrella policy, well, then maybe the insurer could shop elsewhere. If they're told, we don't offer this, or if they're told, as they're supposed to, you can purchase it in this policy. Here's what the cost would be. What has boiled down, I think there's really two issues in this case. The first and primary issue was, does 632.32 apply to just primary policies, or does it apply to primary policies of insurance and umbrella policies?
But here the umbrella policy, maybe you correct me if I'm wrong, but as I recall, the umbrella policy here did talk about underinsured, and it said there isn't any. So it did say that. So if they read the policy, they would have known that there wasn't any coverage for that.
Maybe. It's the 21st of 25 exclusions. And it does say, all it states is that this policy does not provide for UIM coverage unless specifically endorsed. To some consumers or to people on the public, I don't know that that's really clear indication that you can purchase UIM coverage for this policy and here's how it works. And what the legislator wanted the insurers to do, which it said in the statute, is provide separate written notice. Don't bury it in the policy. Don't put it as the 21st of 25 exclusions and tell them that they're not purchasing UIM. But give them a separate written notice. And that's actually, that's what happened in the underlying policy. American Family, in conjunction with the delivery of the underlying policy, includes a one-page statement which tracks the language of 632.32.4M, and it states to the consumer in very simple, direct language, you can purchase UIM.
Counselor, could you please speak to what weight, if any, we ought to give to the administrative code provision, INS 677, please?
That would be the exempted provisions?
Yes.
I think it's to be given great weight, because in 1987, I believe it was, the OCI exempted two provisions from 632.32, and that's critical for two reasons. One, they specifically, by exempting provisions, and just so everyone is aware, 630, or the administrative code specifically exempted two provisions from 632.32 from umbrella policies, sub 2 and sub 4. Sub 2 having to do, or one having to do with $1,000 in MedPay coverage, one having to do with the requirement to provide at least $25,000 in UM. What the OCI said was, you don't have to do that in umbrella policies. First reason that it's critical is if 632.32 only applied to primary policies, there would have been no reason to address that in an administrative code. You could have just ignored it because then the presumption would have been it doesn't apply. But the OCI actually took the step of exempting those two provisions. To me, that's the OCI's way of saying 632.32 applies to every policy, but not these two provisions. We'll specifically exempt those from umbrella policies. Secondly, in 1995, 4M was enacted. This is after sub 2 and sub 4 were exempted. Last 10 years, since 1995, OCI has not taken the extra step of exempting 4M, and it has ever had every opportunity to do so. So they specifically exempted 2 and 4, that they've had the opportunity to, and they have not exempted 4M. And in 1995, they sent an alert to insurers about the provisions of 4M, but they did not indicate in there that they were going to exempt it like they did 2 and 4. So I think it is critical, because I think what we're seeing here is guidance from the Office of the Commissioner of Insurance that 632.32 does, as we've maintained all along and as the Court of Appeals agreed, applies to every policy. It doesn't just apply to primary policies. The only two provisions that don't are sub 2 and sub 4, and the OCI has the power to do that. And I don't think there's really, in my mind, I don't think there's really much of a debate at this point as to whether or not 632.32 applies to umbrella policies. You have the Yadeberg decision, which I cited in my brief, which is a case from approximately 10 years ago, also involving American Family, where intra-insured suits were discussed and whether or not those applied to an umbrella policy. And both American Family and the Court of Appeals acknowledged that they did apply because their umbrella policies were required to track the requirements of 632.32 stats. So there was an acknowledgement in the Yadeberg case that, yes, these applied to every policy. In addition to Yadeberg, you have the OCI that is specifically exempting some portions. The OCI is telling us, yes, 632.32 applies to every policy of insurance. And the plain language of the statute. The statute doesn't say for every primary policy or for every policy other than umbrella policies. It says every policy. You look at those three factors, and I don't think there's really much of a legitimate dispute that 632.32 does apply. I think the next critical question, the Court of Appeals in this case agreed, the next critical question is, okay, does 4M then also apply? Again, OCI had the opportunity over the past 10 years to exempt it, like it did to sub 2 and sub 4. It has not done so. Logically, what we're doing with 4M and what the legislature was doing with 4M, provision for subchapter 4M, is telling insurers to give the notice, to educate the consumers, let them know what they can purchase, let them know that it's possible to not only protect yourself against liability, but protect yourself from others out there that don't have adequate insurance. Why would that only apply then to primary policies? Logically, let them know for all policies. Let the consumer make an educated decision. If the legislature said, no, just do it for primary policies, they would have said so.
Counselor, if I had a policy that was a homeowner's policy and I didn't drive a car, but I was worried about getting hit by somebody that wasn't insured adequately, and I bought an umbrella policy to cover me for liability over the top of my homeowner's policy, would I be able to buy UIM coverage from your umbrella?
That's a very good question. More than likely you would be, because UIM policies would specifically cover you if, like in either this case, if you were struck by a car, if you were in a friend's car and you were hit by an uninsured driver, more than likely they would allow you to purchase the coverage. Quite frankly, I've never heard of a situation like that. I don't know if in the practical world that has occurred, but I don't see any reason why you couldn't.
Well, one of the reasons I asked the question is if you have to give the notice and you want to just interpret the statute simply, that means you have to give it to everyone. And everyone who buys umbrella coverage doesn't always buy it to go over automobile policies. For example, the person who doesn't drive but has a homeowner's policy would often have a liability policy to cover them for a terrible fall on their property more than they would ever anticipate. And so if you have to give the notice, then you have to give it to everyone. That means everyone's got to have the ability to buy UIM coverage. Otherwise, you really wouldn't need to give the notice to everyone. And it goes to the other side's argument, I think, a bit about not having the notice of UIM apply to excess policies. Am I making any sense?
Well, and if I'm following, I think in that situation, the notice requirement vis-a-vis umbrella policies is even more important. Because here you have part of the Court of Appeals reasoning, which obviously I think was faulty, but they reason that, well, they got notice in their underlying policy.
Right.
Therefore, this consumer knew what was going on with UIM coverage. And I'll address that. I don't agree with that. But in your scenario,
right,
you would have a potential consumer who may have no idea what UIM coverage is.
Right.
In that situation, the insurer could still, under the scenario that we have, say, no, we're not required. We're not required to provide this coverage. And if the consumer is taking the responsible step of going out and purchasing a good insurance policy, let them know.
But, you know, another thing that troubles me, if you look at this umbrella policy that's here, it lists the liability coverages that the purchaser has. That purchaser did have 100,000-300,000 UIM, but that's not on the face of the umbrella policy. And I'm just wondering, since the other coverages are on its face, if I really could buy excess coverage when I don't have primary coverage for the same risk, or can you just say, well, I'm going to pick this out of the air at some later point in time?
Well, and that's, I think, where the confusion also dovetailing with that is American Family, and this is where I take issue with the Court of Appeals also. American Family, in addition, on the underlying policy, provided that separate notice that I mentioned. The one page, very plain language, here's what you can purchase. When you're telling, or when you're arguing, as American Family does, that you don't have to provide that in our excess policy, now you've told the consumer with a separate piece of paper, here you can buy UIM in our underlying policy, you haven't provided that on the umbrella. A reasonable consumer would look at that and say, yeah, I got that sheet with the underlying, I got nothing with the umbrella, must not be available. And when the deck page doesn't even include the underlying coverage for 100, 300 for UIM, again, I think a reasonable consumer would then draw the conclusion that it's not available for purchase in this policy. And I understand the law says that they're responsible to read the policy. The law doesn't allow a consumer to turn a blind eye. But the reason the legislature said do the separate sheet of paper is because we just can't expect a reasonable consumer even to flip through a very lengthy policy and spot exemption 21 out of 25 and know what exactly it means. Again, we're dealing with sophisticated people in this room, obviously, that have read a lot of policies that know what all this insurance language
means.
But
isn't that a separate issue? I mean, the issue of what they bought, to me, is separate from the issue of notice of what they could buy. I'm really looking at the issue of notice of what they could buy, and if they had an obligation under the statute, regardless of what the policy said that they bought, what flows from not completing that obligation. So I was on a different page.
Okay, and I apologize. I agree, to that extent, I agree with the Court of Appeals.
Uh-huh.
I think the Court of Appeals was accurate when they said 632.32 does require them to give the notice. Where, again, I differ from the Court of Appeals' argument is they got from point A, which was give the notice, to point B, the notice being adequate by ignoring what the legislature said. The legislature said give a separate written notice. Court of Appeals said, well, but there was a notice attached to the primary and there's this endorsement in the policy. That's good enough for us. We're listening to the legislature on one hand and saying give the separate written notice, but we're ignoring the legislature when it says here's what's reasonable notice. And it's simple. It's a one-page document that you give. And then, obviously, then the burden falls upon the insured to now ask the agent, what is this? How would this work? And given the costs, given the extra cost that would be involved, I can't imagine a reasonable consumer who's now going to spend, in the grand scheme of insurance costs, a minimal amount of money to get this umbrella coverage that's going to say no to a slight increase to now put that coverage just slightly further and protect yourself even more from other people out there that don't have the adequate coverage or no coverage. It's just the legislature's way of saying, get that notice out there. Get the public educated. And I want to stress also that there's nothing in this statute, and we are not making the argument by any means that this somehow is a statutory scheme that mandates UIM coverage. Not at all. There are insurers in this state that I'm sure just, one, don't write umbrella policies, period. Two, if they do, they may not offer UIM or UIM coverage. It's very possible. There's nothing that mandates that they do that other than the primary limits as the statute requires. However, all the legislature is saying is that if you do insure, let the public know. Let the public know what they can purchase so they can purchase adequate insurance. As far as what constitutes notice, again, I think it's clear that The Court of Appeals wanted to get to the end result, despite what the facts of this case have shown. Bearing the language in the policy, or just one exclusion in the policy, clearly doesn't satisfy the dictates of what the statute requires. Given that, I just don't believe that there is the actual notice as required, which takes us to the next step, which is, what do we do now? Unfortunately, the statute did not speak to remedy, which is not uncommon. Many statutes out there that create a right don't necessarily create the remedy. What would be the adequate remedy here? What the statute is designed to do is to notify the insurer of what they can purchase, to give them an opportunity to purchase good, quality, adequate insurance. The Wisconsin statutes state that if you write an insurance policy that doesn't conform to a statute, we're not going to let you, the insurer, get away with it. What we're going to do is we'll just reform the policy, and we'll act as if the policy conformed to the Wisconsin statutes. Likewise here, if you have a situation where the insurance company clearly is required to give notice, and they did not give that notice, then I think the only adequate remedy is to follow the dictates of the statute, and we have to act, we have to reform this and give the notice to the insured. And you have to do it retroactively. If you don't do it on a retroactive basis, you've taken away the incentive or the mandate to these insurance companies to provide this notice. Otherwise, they do it only when they get caught. Well, that's not what the legislature wants them to do. They want them to provide this notice at the time that the policy is purchased.
Explain how you would reform the policy.
To the extent that what I would suggest and what I think would be reasonable, and I agree with Justice Kessler from the Court of Appeals on this, is that you would go retroactively back to the date of the purchase, the date of the enactment of the insurance, provide the notice to the Rebernicks and say as of June 7, I believe, or what, May of 2001, when you purchase this policy, you have the right to purchase UIM coverage. Here's what coverage is available. Do you want to purchase it? And give them the opportunity to purchase the coverage as of the date of the policy, which again would be May of 2001. If you don't do that, then you have a statute with no teeth. You have a statute that tells the insurer, give the notice, but if you don't, oh well.
How much would they buy?
That would buy, in this case, it would buy $1 million worth of coverage, because American Family would offer for purchase a UIM policy that would be equivalent to the amount of the umbrella.
Could you explain why they wouldn't have bought that coverage under their insurance policy, their automobile insurance policy?
Why they didn't buy the $1 million of UIM coverage? Right. You know, again, they purchased a $100,000 primary policy. They purchased an equivalent amount of UIM coverage. Again, I think that's relatively standard. Could they have? Quite frankly, I don't know. If you could purchase a $100,000 or $250,000 primary policy and then purchase $1 million of UIM, I doubt it. I would assume that the insurer would tell you that that would fall under the purview of an umbrella policy. So could they have? I don't know. Is that standard practice? I don't believe so. I think what they purchased was a pretty typical policy of underlying coverage of $100,000 per accident, $300,000 total, with equivalent amounts of UM and UIM.
The minimum underlying insurance limits for a car, I'm reading from your policy, the policy was $100,000 per person and $300,000 per occurrence. So they would have had, in order to come under the umbrella policy, they'd have to need those limits. Now, that applies to additional liability. I don't know if it applies to UIM. Do you have any idea what I'm talking about?
Not right now. I apologize.
In order to get liability coverage for a car under the umbrella,
Okay. You
needed underlying car insurance of $100,000, $300,000.
At least, Right.
That's the minimum, right. Minimum required underlying limits. I don't know if that would have been the required underlying minimum under UIM or whether under UIM you need any required minimum.
Without the UIM endorsement to this policy, we don't know that. My guess is that American Family probably would require. Usually umbrellas always require the underlying limits. There has to be some underlying limits, usually 100. I don't know of any insurer that writes umbrella policies over $25,000 policies or $50,000 policies. So my expectation would be the insurer would require that there'd be a minimum of 100,000 UIM.
Well, then, Counselor, how could I buy that policy you and I were talking about before? Because my example was I'm a non-driver. I don't have an automobile policy, but I'm afraid of getting hit by someone that's not well insured. So I want to buy it in my liability umbrella that sits over the top of my homeowners, and I thought you told me I could do that.
That's a good question. I think in that type of situation, the policy would just have to be endorsed then to indicate that you don't own a car, that there are no underlying limits for the auto portion. I'm sure that they would require the underlying limits with regard to the homeowners. They would want you to have minimum amounts for the homeowners, but there would have to be an acknowledgement on the part of the insurance company that you don't have a primary policy of automobile insurance. So in that type of situation, that would have to be taken into account, no question.
You have F, let's see, what's that, 7F, which says, with respect to the use of a car not owned by you or relatives, not furnished for your regular use, insured means you or your relatives. And use, as I understand it in that provision, can mean you as a passenger.
Correct.
So I don't know how F fits. I guess it's a liability issue if as a passenger you create, you're negligent and create a insurance and you might need something different on underinsured. But in, and you don't, is, does the record have the form underinsured motorist endorsement? Had they purchased it so we can look at that?
Yes, it should be a part of the record. Their,
okay.
Their primary policy is part of the record, which would include their UIM endorsement.
No, but I want to know what their umbrella UIM would be had they bought it.
Part of the record.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Gutschmidt. Mr. Banks.
Good afternoon. I'm Neil Banks, representing American Family Insurance Company. May it please the Court and Counsel. Justice Anderson, to answer your question, it is a part of the record. There's an affidavit in the record that we filed with our summary judgment motion indicating what would have been offered had they purchased, I'm sorry, what the endorsement would have been had they purchased the policy. So that is a part of the record.
And what does it say about somebody who doesn't have an auto, is not, doesn't drive, and is not insured? Can you get UIM?
No. It doesn't speak to that, but the insurance policy requires that you have the same underlying limits that you would with respect to UIM. So you cannot, Justice Rogensack's example, if you own a home and you don't own a car, you can purchase an excess policy, but you just can't purchase UIM in that policy.
It's a different policy than UIM.
Well, it requires that you have similar underlying limits of $100,000. So no, you cannot purchase it if you just own a home and don't own a car, to answer that question.
So if you can't purchase it and I'm buying an umbrella policy from you, then you don't have to give me notice of its availability, right?
Well, it makes sense to give you notice in that instance because it's not available.
Exactly, and that's what my example was going to. Okay, thank you. That helps.
You're welcome. Thank you. When we look at Section 632.32.4M, and you read it together with the scope. The scope says, except as otherwise provided. And that language we've been looking over in this case or looking past in this case considerably, both at the trial court level, the court of appeals level, and hopefully now we won't look past it. It says, the scope of 632.32, it begins with, except as otherwise provided. Then when you go to subsection 4M of the statute, and I'm not going to read the whole statute, just the first beginning of it, it says, an insurer writing policies that insure with respect to a motor vehicle. And that's where I want to stop. It talks about a motor vehicle. It doesn't, specific motor vehicle. It doesn't talk about motor vehicles. You see, umbrella policies are geared to, are not specifically insuring automobiles. Now, yes, it may cover someone who is injured in an automobile if they have the appropriate coverage. It may cover if someone's a passenger in an automobile, but what it doesn't do is it doesn't insure a specific automobile. For example, when one purchases an automobile, that automobile policy only covers one vehicle. That's what this language is talking about with respect to a motor vehicle. It's singular, not plural. You can have, or in this day and age, we have people who buy two and three vehicles for one driver. In that instance, you must have three separate automobile policies to cover each one of those automobiles. With respect to an umbrella policy, that's not a requirement. An umbrella policy does not specifically name a policy because it's not an automobile policy. An umbrella policy covers defamation, it covers self-defense, it covers invasion of privacy, it covers false imprisonment, it covers false arrest, malicious prosecution, wrongful eviction, civil board type of duties if you're sued because you're on a civil board. An umbrella policy is what we consider a catastrophic policy. Now,
also, just so I was listening to you and perhaps I misunderstood, you said for each separate vehicle you have to have a separate policy. But in my mind's eye, I can have one policy, an insurance policy that covers five vehicles. In other words, I have a Jeep and I have a passenger car and I have a truck. They're all covered under one policy, aren't they?
No, they're all covered under an insurance company, but there's three separate policies.
Well, even if they're listed, you usually get one piece of paper.
I get one
policy.
I get one policy.
You may get one policy, but those are separate policies. You have actually, if you got a debt sheet, it will individually list, the declaration sheet, it will individually list the cars, and it individually lists the different charges. You're not paying one charge for all of those.
You're correct. I guess I was trying to visualize and personalize it that I have, say, three or four vehicles, and I have one policy with a specific company. But you're saying each vehicle has, it has underinsured, it has a million, this, you know, whatever.
Absolutely. As you recall, there used to be a lot of stacking cases.
Right.
Before the statute was changed, you guys don't recall that. Yes. And so that's what they were doing. They were stacking the policies on top of one another.
Yes.
Okay. So, now, an overwhelming number of jurisdictions that have a law similar to Wisconsin.
Thank you, and I didn't want to bring up stacking, so.
Yeah, I know that's a painful subject for you guys.
Yeah.
Although the pain is over now.
Tell us about it. If the pain is over, why do we have so many?
But anyway, an overwhelming number of jurisdictions in Wisconsin that have similar laws to Wisconsin, they hold UM/UIM notice or mandatory coverage provisions. They hold that they do not apply to excess policies. In many of these cases, the statutes that are being interpreted indicate that, quote, every policy must have a particular provision in it. These states that I'm talking about are called minimum recovery states. Wisconsin is a minimum recovery state. So minimum recovery states require drivers to have a minimum amount of liability coverage. That's opposite of what's called full recovery states. Full recovery states require that UM limits or UIM limits, when offered or when required in a policy, must equal the liability limits. For example, In Wisconsin, you can buy a $100,000/$300,000 policy. You can also have UM limits of $25,000 in that policy, so they don't, that's the minimum amount of coverage. With respect to UIM, the limit or the minimum is $50,000. So you can have $50,000 UIM in a Wisconsin policy and a $100,000 liability limit. In full recovery states, that is not possible because the legislature has required that when UM is offered or UIM is offered, that they have to offer the exact same amount as the BI limits or the bodily injury limits. Now, that's because different states have different public policy when it comes to minimum recovery or full recovery. Again, Wisconsin is a minimum recovery state. And here's the deal. In minimum recovery states, the public policy is that we want to make sure that in the event you have an injury or an accident, that at least you have the minimum amount covered, at least the minimum amount. Full recovery states are different. Full recovery states, they have a different philosophy. They want to make sure that the person gets the full recovery in the event they're an accident or injury. Now, most full recovery states are those states where there is a problem with people who don't drive with insurance. For example, Arizona has a lot of immigrants who come to the United States and they drive vehicles. They can't get licenses sometimes, and they drive vehicles. They don't have a license. They can't get insurance.
It's so like Milwaukee.
It's like Milwaukee in certain areas, no doubt. In any event, they don't have coverage, so they have a problem in Arizona with a lot of uninsured accidents. So Arizona has a public policy of requiring that it's a full recovery state. UIM limits and UM limits must equal the BI limits. Now, in the states that have a minimum recovery philosophy, like Wisconsin, they define automobile insurance a little differently than some others. They universally indicate that automobile policies insure against the risk of loss through the operation of a vehicle. Excess policies, these minimum recovery states, indicate that are fundamentally designed to protect against catastrophic loss. And that's what an umbrella policy, excess policy, is designed to do.
Mr. Banks, if I can stop you there, because I refer to page 10 of your brief, and I have to confess that when I see this, this signals something to me. A literal construction of the statute should not be adopted if obvious legislative purpose would be defeated. The spirit and intention of a statute should govern over the statute's literal meaning. I then look back at the literal meaning of the statute, and if you look at 4M under A or B, each policy shall provide to one insured written notice. And then you go back to sub 1 and you focused on the terms except as otherwise provided. I don't see where it's otherwise provided that it would apply to every policy. So given the construction of those three statutes, subsections of the statute together, it's at least a plain meaning without getting to history, without getting to interpreting the statute, would suggest that each policy should have notes. And if you're looking at each policy, and this was a question I was going to ask Mr. Overchuk, but his time ran out, when you're dealing with an umbrella policy, you call it excess coverage. But are we talking about one policy or two policies?
We're talking about excess policy?
When you're talking about the umbrella policy, is that a separate policy from the underlying auto policy?
Yes, it is.
All right, so if it's a separate policy, we're talking about two policies, why doesn't the statute control?
The statute doesn't control because there's two reasons. Number one, it talks about a motor vehicle registered in a principal garage in the state. My point earlier was this is talking specifically about a automobile policy, a specific vehicle. It doesn't say motor vehicles. So this policy, it can be read two ways. policy that insures as to one vehicle, is the way I read this one. Or it could be, or be interpreted to say, a policy that has anything to do with an automobile. The intent of the legislature here was to give notice with respect to automobiles, automobile policies. That's why I was going through the painfully going through the minimum versus full recovery states, because they give us an excellent example as to what each state in the union have found with respect to similar laws that we have in Wisconsin. And that is, there are minimum recovery states. The courts, the Supreme Courts, in particular the Supreme Court of Alabama, South Carolina, have found that excess policies are not automobile policies. It is not. If we look at the administrative rule, the administrative provision that was talked about before, 6.77, INS 6.77, it exempts umbrella policies and excess policies from subsection 4. Subsection 4 deals with mandatory coverage or mandatory uninsured motorists. Subsection 4M, and I assume the legislature put 4M under 4 for a reason. Number one, they knew that 6.77 exempted umbrella and excess insurers from the UM requirements. It really doesn't make much sense for them to exempt the UM part of the statute, but not exempt the UIM part of the statute. Couple reasons. One, everybody who has or buys an excess insurance policy doesn't necessarily have an automobile. To make every insurer of an excess policy to give notice of the availability of UIM when one doesn't have an automobile doesn't really make any sense. If one were to get that notice, I assume they would be confused, especially when they would call us and we would tell them, you can't buy it because you don't have an automobile. Then we'd be back in front of the Supreme Court with another issue. You told them it was available, but it was not available.
But wouldn't that go to the except as otherwise provided language? There I could see the distinction, but the question in your case involves an individual that had underinsured motorist coverage. So if we're talking about a person that's already got the coverage, now we're talking about two policies, not one, and you're doing so in the face of a statute that says each policy should have this notice. What am I missing?
Well, it does say each policy. There's no question. But again, it says the exception, except otherwise provided, and that's what I'm arguing is 4M is an exception, except as otherwise provided.
But I don't see the exception in 4M is what I'm getting at. I can see an exception in 4M where, as you argued before, a person doesn't have the underlying automobile coverage at all. But where a person does have the coverage, I don't see anywhere in 4M that gives you the except as otherwise provided language. I don't see where it's accepted out.
I'm accepting it out in the language that says that insured with respect to a motor vehicle. Every policy, the language is every policy, except as otherwise provided, every policy shall do this. Otherwise provided with respect to a motor vehicle. This is, when I say a motor vehicle, I'm talking about an automobile policy which specifically insures a vehicle. If that makes any sense to you, maybe it doesn't. But umbrella policies do not specifically insure vehicles. Umbrella policies insure people. Umbrella policies insure and make sure that one is protected from a catastrophic loss. An umbrella policy follows a person wherever they go.
Maybe I'm asking the wrong question. Can an umbrella policy, I'm saying it wrong, can an umbrella policy be written that would cover uninsured or underinsured vehicles?
Absolutely. In fact, American Family does offer UM and or UIM if one requested any excess policy. So it is offered. But
then if you can get that, then doesn't that fit within the language of the first sentence of 4M? For those where it can be offered. In other words, if you had the underlying underinsured protection, doesn't that first sentence then include it? That's why I'm having trouble seeing the except as otherwise provided.
Sure, I understand. One can read this statute just as you've just indicated, that it one can read it, I don't think it should be read that way, but one can read it whereby they would think that a UM policy, an excess policy, might be required. One could read it that way.
But you don't want us to.
That's what I want you to.
I just wanted to make that clear. Why not?
Well, if one were to read it that way, you might have a technical violation of a statute, but in this case, of the statute, but in this case, we then look at legislative intent. I'm sorry, Justice Bailey.
I'm having a problem, and I'm having a problem because my mindset follows your standard of review discussion. And your standard of review discussion is pointed out by Justice Butler, seemed to me to lead me, and I guess that's where my mindset was in this case, that, look, the language might be plain, but to read it the way that it seems to read leads to absurd results, is contrary to the purpose, is rendered ambiguous by the context. I mean, that's what you have in line after line. However, the plain language of the statute should not be construed in the manner that leads to absurd or unreasonable results. Therefore, courts should not look to a single isolated sentence, but read it in context. In addition, it must be noted that statutory language, unambiguous on its face, I'm reading all of this from page 9. Excuse me for not saying so earlier. On its face can sometimes be rendered ambiguous by the context in which it was applied, depending on the facts, I mean, et cetera, et cetera. All of that is boilerplate to say, hey, it may seem to say that, but it really can't mean that. You got to look at the history. You got to look at the purpose. You got to look at the context. And to read it the way that you're reading it would render absurd results. Now, but that's not what you're arguing now. It seems to me you're arguing, you got to focus on a motor vehicle in the text of the statute. I must be wrong, but don't you have an argument that, okay, it reads as you read it, as the Court of Appeals read it, but to do so would render it absurd? I know in the amicus brief, that's one of the arguments that it would, render it absurd.
That's coming from me also.
Okay, so let me hear that argument.
This statute has two purposes. The one purpose of the statute is to describe what underinsured coverage is. The next part of the statute is geared to explain to the purchaser of automobile policies that underinsured motorist is available under the auto policy. Statute does not require notice under other circumstances. For example, statute does not require notice when the insured purchases UIM, which is exactly what happened in this particular case. In the Rebinick case, Mr. Rebinick purchased UIM coverage. Even though he purchased UIM coverage, we still gave him the notice. And the statute says notice is unnecessary when the insured knows what it is and that it's available. And that's what happened in this case. The statute was geared, this is a notice statute. And there's no question, it's a notice statute. It's a notice to give an insured basically a heads up that in an auto policy, you can get UIM coverage and allow the insured to purchase it if they intend to do so. We have to look at what is the legislature's intent with respect to this statute. The intent is to educate, which we've done in this particular case. Mr. Rebenick was given the notice, and in fact, Mr. Rebenick didn't even need the notice because he had already purchased it when we sent him the notice. So he knew what it is. He knew that it was available. Next, we have to look at...
Let me interrupt because perhaps I wasn't focused enough. Why would a plain meaning of reading of this statute, and if it's read to say each insurance policy has to, you know, contain this notice, why would that render an absurd result?
Because in this particular case, if we look at this statute and the intent of the legislature behind this statute, and we read it to say that excess policies must give notice to advise the insurer that excess coverage is available and to explain what it is, in this case, it would be an absurd result because Mr. Rebenick, number one, knew what UIM was and, in fact, purchased it in the underlying policy. So to indicate in this particular case that the UIM carrier had to give notice would lead to an absurd result because it would defeat what the legislative... You're going to say something.
Yeah, I'm going to say something. Notice of begs the question, of what? Notice of what it is? No, he already knows that. He has the underlying policy. Notice of availability?
Absolutely. He knows it's available. In fact, we can go a step back.
How does he know it's available in his umbrella policy?
Well, there's two ways he knows. First of all, he knows it's available because, well, let me back up. With respect to an excess policy, the excess policy indicates, I know counsel keeps saying the provision that the Court of Appeals discussed is number 21 of 25 exclusions. But we have a duty to read our policies, and in that policy, it does state that this policy does not have UIM unless there's a specific endorsement that said it does, which would lead anyone to read that to say, I can get UIM in this policy, I just have to get an endorsement to do so. There's not a necessity that he get an explanation of what UIM is, because again, he purchased UIM before we even gave him notice of what UIM was. And so he knows what UIM is. He reads his policy, he can see that he can purchase UIM and the umbrella policy.
Counselor, did they have three cars? As I'm looking at the umbrella policy, it says car liability insurance on it, and then underneath it says 03 car, and then the S is in a bracket. And I guess I'm understanding your argument a little bit better now than I did before, and that your plain meaning of a 4M is that in the language just doesn't apply to an umbrella because the umbrella doesn't say a Ford Pinto and a Jeep Cherokee. It just says you have to have underlying liability coverage on one car, 10 cars, 50 cars, and we're going to go over what that stated amount is, correct?
That is correct.
Okay. So I don't know if you know if they had more than one car, but it looks to me like they had three. But whatever car or cars they had, they're not described as being any particular kind of car. And that's how it differs from 4M, which describes a particular kind of car.
That is exactly my argument.
Yeah, okay, thank you. It finally dawned on me.
I hope everybody else understood that.
They probably did. It's probably just me.
That may be, but your definitions are deal differently with people who own the particular car, people who don't own it but use it. So it may be that this doesn't cover express particular cars, but it does cover, it may have different coverage depending upon owned cars versus non-owned cars.
Well, the way the umbrella policies work is, as I stated before, an umbrella policy goes with you where you go. it covers or can cover everything in your life. It even covers your pets that cause damages. An umbrella policy is all-inclusive. It's not a specific policy. It's geared to one thing, and that is to cover a catastrophic loss. Not to cover the fact that you're driving an automobile and happen to get into an automobile accident. That's what the auto policy is for. The umbrella policy is a totally different animal. Again, it's personal, it's portable, it goes with wherever you go. You can be at a board meeting and make a bad decision and get sued, and your umbrella policy will defend you and indemnify you if there's any liability. You can be on a board on a benevolent organization, a charitable organization, and your umbrella policy can cover you for any negligence that you may be hit with.
Mr. Banks, if I could, I want to go to your argument regarding the last sentence of 4MA1 or A2, that insurers required to provide notice, the notice required under the subdivision, only one time and in conjunction with the delivery of the policy. Both of those sentences in a roundabout way get there. Why shouldn't I be able to read those sentences in conjunction with sub 4MB and, B and C, that talks in terms of acceptance or rejection of an underinsured motorist coverage by a person after being notified under paragraph A need not be in writing. The rejection of such coverage by a person notified under paragraph A shall apply to all persons insured under the policy, including any renewal. And then under sub C, similarly, if a person rejects after being notified, the insurer is not required to provide such coverage under a policy that is renewed. And then D, if they accept, it continues at that rate. Why doesn't the last section of sentence of A1 and A2 refer to sub C and D in terms of how they should be applied, saying, look, you got one policy. If you reject it when we offer it the first time, we don't have to offer it anymore. But if you take it the first time, we'll continue it at that rate every time we renew your policy, as opposed to what you've argued how it should be applied to with an excess or separate policy. It's a different policy. That's the problem that I'm having with extending that argument to a different policy, the umbrella policy.
The requirement that we only give notice one time and don't have to give notice again?
Yeah.
Well, the reason for that, of course, is we're required to educate them as to what underinsured motorist is. Once an insured is educated, then there's no further requirement
for notice given. I don't mean to interrupt, but the education is supposed to tell them what is available. And it's one thing to tell them what is available with the base policy. It's another thing to tell them what's available with respect to the umbrella policy. You're dealing with different limits, aren't you?
Oh, we're definitely dealing with different limits.
Yeah.
Because one is, again, a catastrophic policy, and one is the underlying policy.
Well, how would a person know that unless they were told?
How would they know that the umbrella policy had UIM?
Had UIM and had the limits at the rates that you offered. At the limits that you offer them.
Well, first of all, there's no requirement that we tell them what the limits are that we offer. There's no requirement that we have to say we offer it at a million, 5 million, or 10 million. With respect to them knowing that it's available, again, it's our position that the statute doesn't require us to do that, but if there is a requirement, then there's a technical violation, and in this instance, again, the policy itself in the exclusion tells them there is no UIM in this policy, but you can purchase it by an endorsement. It's clear, and again, they keep talking about it being buried at 21, number 21 and 25, but the policy is only 6 pages long. We're not looking at a policy that's 100 pages long. It's a 6-page policy that can easily be read by any insured. And it states clearly in there that it is available, you can buy it, and in this instance, Mr. Rebeck knew what underinsured motorist coverage is.
Does that exception 21 or whatever it is provide a description of what UIM is?
No, that exception does not.
But isn't that a requirement of the statute? The statute requires, as I read it, two things. Now, whether or not it applies to the umbrella is the question before us. But to that which it does apply, you have to give the customer notice of its availability, and the notice has to include a written, a brief description of the coverage. You are claiming that your exception 21 gives the notice regarding availability. Are you also claiming, and if so, in what language does it also comply with the statutory requirement that it include a brief description of the coverage?
I'm not claiming that that provision gives a brief description of the coverage because section number 21 of exclusions does not. In this instance, the plaintiff already knew. He had underinsured coverage in his underlying policy. He could have purchased $1 million. He could have purchased $1 million with his auto policy had he wanted that. But he didn't. He purchased $100,000. You got to understand, American Family is in the business of selling insurance. We want to sell these policies to those who want them. It's not a situation where we're trying to take away something that we've given somebody. It's not some we're trying to interpret an endorsement of our policy. Here, he just didn't buy it. He knew it was available. He didn't buy it. He could have bought $1 million. If he wants $1 million of coverage, he could have bought $1 million in the underlying policy. Now, of course, a catastrophic loss occurs, and, of course, the claim now is, I want $1 million in the coverage. Actually, we know what he wants in the coverage. We talk about what the remedy would be. The remedy in a situation where an underlying policy, an automobile policy, failed to give the proper notice would be to allow the jury to decide what are the damages. Because, again, we've got to look at, number one, would he have purchased the policy? Number two, what was his financial condition? Could he afford to purchase another policy? There are many people who buy policies, and they get the bare minimum, and they get what they can get based upon what they can afford. And that will be another consideration in this case. If there is a breach of an automobile carrier on the automobile policy, we still got to determine what the damages are. How much would he have purchased? Would he have purchased $1 million, $5 million, $10 million? We don't know that in this case. Again, the statutory purpose has been met in this case. The intent of the statute is to inform and ensure that underinsured motorist is available under the policy and to explain what it is. Mr. Rebenick got the explanation, even though he didn't need the explanation. An excess policy is a catastrophic policy geared to travel with an insured wherever he or she or their family may go to protect them overall from catastrophic losses.
Can I ask a couple of fact questions? The umbrella policy was purchased for the first time in May 2001?
About a week after the automobile policy was purchased, yes.
Had the automobile policy been purchased
before? Yes. The automobile policy was purchased on the 29th of April, and the umbrella policy was on the 7th.
What happened before April 2001? Was there a different carrier or?
That we don't know. I shouldn't say that. Well, there was really no discovery in this case. The question was a legal question as to whether or not it was required. So there was no discussion on, or no discovery on who he had before and what he knew before.
Does the record tell us whether Agent Norvick met with the Rebernecks?
No, the record does not say that. I could go outside the record, but the record doesn't say that.
Well, maybe better not. Could you explain to someone who really doesn't understand this why would you buy an umbrella coverage? You've got your underlying policy. What are the motivations for buying umbrella coverage?
Most individuals who buy umbrella policies are individuals who have assets that need to be protected. For example, somebody who has a significant home or somebody who has significant funds in a bank account. Someone who has children away in college, for example, might want to buy an umbrella policy because you never know what your kids might do when they're in another state.
We're at home.
So
maybe your kids.
But in any event, the purpose of purchasing an umbrella policy is for catastrophic losses. Because in most states like Wisconsin, you can tap somebody in the rear ender and they can end up with $200,000 or $300,000 in medical bills. In that instance, if you only have a $100,000, $300,000 policy, now you are underinsured, and without an excess policy, you now become personally responsible for that. Your dog might go out and bite somebody.
But this is for your liability. This is for accidents that you cause. That's what an umbrella is. So if I go out and I have an auto accident, the umbrella is to cover any excess above my negligence, my fault, correct?
That is the purpose behind excess coverage. You, anyone in your family who resides in your household.
Right.
That's what I don't quite understand is, let's take these other folks. They bought an underlying automobile insurance policy. I don't know what they paid for that. Perhaps the record tells that. But then, the coverage is fairly modest here, $150,000 of liability, $300,000 per occurrence. Now they've got $1 million umbrella coverage. That's only $136 a year.
The reason for that, catastrophic losses occur at a much lesser rate than the average accident loss. And that is why umbrella policies are typically cheaper than an underlying policy, because you don't have as many catastrophic losses as you do the losses on a regular run-of-the-mill automobile accident. Usually a regular run-of-the-mill auto accident can cover your losses. Usually if somebody comes on your property and slips and fall, your homeowner's coverage can cover that. It's for the catastrophic losses. It's for the losses where there is a horrible accident that you may have been responsible in causing, because now you want to make sure that your personal assets, you want to make sure that everything you work for all of your life is now protected. And that's why you don't get an excess policy. You may be on a board that's unreasonable, but the fact that you're on that board, and that board makes a decision that's contrary to what a claimant think they should have made, you may get sued there on that board. Your umbrella policy will protect you.
It's cheaper to buy UIM than to increase the coverage under your car.
It's cheaper to buy the excess?
The umbrella. Yes, the umbrella.
Yeah. Not necessarily. It's not necessarily true.
But because from $100,000 to $500,000 on your straight liability is cheap compared to what to pay for the first $100,000.
But you have to be at fault. I mean, we've had a couple of insurance cases today, and we're asking these, quote, personal questions to...
we're all calling our insurance agents immediately.
We're expecting someone to come and solicit us the minute we're done here. We may have to buy some more.
Regardless of the result of the case.
Free advice. Definitely get an umbrella policy.
But umbrella policies also obviously can include UIM. So it's not just for your exposure for liability.
Right? It's to protect you.
It is to protect you. But UIM is an extra coverage which in almost every policy has to be an endorsement.
Yes.
Because it's not what's regularly covered under an excess policy. Again, an excess policy is a catastrophic loss policy.
What I don't quite understand, and I'm sorry to be so obtuse here, I think I have $500,000. I probably should have more on personal liability and $500,000 on UIM. Why shouldn't I go down to to $100,000 or $150,000 and then buy umbrella coverage. I mean, it's just
a good idea.
It is a smart idea, usually.
We told you that.
Listen to your fellow justices.
My agent will call you.
Now, sometimes it is cheaper to buy UIM in your automobile policy than it is to add to your excess policy. It just depends. But anyone who has any substantial assets or anyone who could potentially lose their assets should have a catastrophic loss policy, an umbrella policy.
But you can't get the umbrella policy for UIM unless you already have it in your underlying policy.
That is correct. You must have UIM on your underlying policy in order to qualify to get an excess policy.
Yeah.
If you don't have it under your automobile policy, you are not eligible for UIM benefits, at least in the American Family policy and pretty much in every other policy I deal with other carriers.
Thanks, because we all have to call our insurance agents. I'm going to say, unless there are further questions, we're going to say thank you, and then we're going to hear from Mr. Ogachak.
Thank you. Definitely get an umbrella. Definitely get it endorsed. Or UIM. And
get it big.
But, you know, we had talked about this before on my argument. I believe Justice Bradley asked me this, which is when you're protecting your assets, when you purchase a liability or an excess policy, you're not only protecting your assets from exposure, from liability exposure, but you're also, the expectation is you're protecting yourself from the catastrophic injuries also that happen to you. And that's as important a factor to insure as protecting your own liability. That's why insurers offer UIM coverage. Because unfortunately there's people out there that don't have, that don't purchase that good insurance that people like the Rebernicks go out and purchase. It gives you the opportunity to protect your assets, which is yourself, your ability to earn a living, your ability to function as a human being. I mean, that is what the UIM coverage is designed to protect. Absurd results. I don't see any rational argument where following the legislative intent in this case would ever lead to an absurd result, because we're not talking about mandated coverage. There's been an argument back and forth about whether, you know, this is not a full coverage or a full recovery state. This is a minimum recovery state. True. The statute does not mandate coverage. It doesn't mandate that insurers offer UIM and umbrellas. It doesn't mandate that it offer limits up to a certain amount. All the statute is a notice requirement. And the notice is simply telling the insurers, or the statute is simply telling the insurers, educate the consumer. Tell the consumer through this notice that the coverage is available for purchase. Not that you have to write it. If you don't want to, don't write it.
Can I ask a question? Because your opposing counsel indicated, and we've had this argument, that there was notice sent, but it only covered the underlying. What your argument is that when you sell an umbrella policy, you have to tell them that you can buy this insurance, but you have to pay extra for it. In other words, it's not normally covered. It's not normally covered under an umbrella policy. That's what your argument is.
Correct. And that's what the statute requires the insurer to do, simply to notify the insured that you can purchase the coverage if you want. And they don't even have to file any notice with the state, or there doesn't have to be a rejection in writing. Failure to pay a premium is evidence that the insured rejected the coverage. It doesn't place a great burden on the insurers. They just have to get a one-page notice, send it along with the policy, letting them know, hey, do you want the UIM coverage? If you're going to spend this small amount more to get this very good coverage, do you want to spend a little bit more to get even better coverage? Why not tell the consumers that? There's absolutely no reason not to require require insurers to do that, especially when the legislature has made it clear through plain language that they should.
Well, your argument is that he thought he should have either been told or he thought he was getting more coverage to cover this type of uninsured motorist? Is that what you're trying to say?
Our argument is that he simply wasn't given the notice of the availability of that business policy.
Right.
Absolutely.
We don't care what he thought. It's just that he didn't get the notice.
Correct. And then, you know, like I said, it leads to the remedy question. The statute is very clear. They have to provide the notice. If they don't provide the notice, and then as we sit here today and we say, oh, well, they had notice through other means, well, then the statute has become rendered, it's been rendered basically meaningless. 632.32, there's ample evidence in this record that it applies to both primary and excess. It's not just written for primary policies. Again, there's no reason. We assume that the legislature acts reasonably when it enacts these laws, that it knows what it's doing, that it knows what the laws are. I think we have to make the same assumption when we deal with the OCI. And when the OCI takes the time to exempt two provisions from 632.32 from excess policies, it's a clear indication that the OCI understands that they apply to excess policies. Why exempt something that wouldn't apply anyway? That would be absurd. Yaderberg clearly applied a provision of 632.32 to excess policies. American Family in that case argued that it was bound by the provisions of 632.32 sub 6 when it writes umbrella policies. There's no doubt that 632.32 applies. The notice wasn't given. It's very plain on its face what type of notice has to be given. And I think the remedy in this case, if not applied, renders the statute meaningless.
Chief, may I? Your remedy is reformation. What kind of consequences do you mean that every excess policy, every umbrella policy in this state that doesn't, that didn't provide notice, and I assume, I don't know this, but let me assume there are lots of companies that don't provide notice. Does that mean that ipso facto, by giving this remedy of reformation, now across the state, all of these umbrella policies that failed to give notice are now going to be deemed to have reformed and have UIM coverage?
Or at the very least, I think these insurers better send the notice out. But if you have certain situations where the insurers continue to ignore the law and refuse to give the notice or don't follow the mandates of the legislature or this court, yes, then they would be reformed if the situation arises. But I think a good insurer would then provide the notice, give their insureds the opportunity to purchase the coverage. What's the danger in that? I think that's a benefit.
I want to try to understand exactly how this works and how you would contemplate this working. There's the underlying automobile insurance policy, and there is a notice of UIM in that material. But I'm assuming that at some point the insured met with an agent, and I suppose they just did this at arm's length. And I would think that there was some kind of notice before that policy was issued. Now, if there is a notice for the umbrella policy, is that simply slipped into the policy so that when the policy arrives, you page through it and say, oh, I can go back and buy UIM coverage? Or should that come before the policy is purchased?
The statute states that it's to be delivered in conjunction with, or it's to be provided in conjunction with the delivery of the policy. I assume that, like in this case, even though they purchased the coverage, American Family, just as a matter of course, provides the written notice when the policy is delivered, whether they purchased the UIM coverage or not. Then, yes, to answer your question, if they don't purchase the coverage, you're giving them the notice now, by the way. If you want to purchase UIM coverage for this policy, it is available. Here's how it works. With regard to the agent, the statute does not require the agent to provide any notice. It's specific to the insurance company. So the agent is under no duty to sell UIM, to offer UIM. it's not a requirement that the legislature placed upon the agent. It specifically placed the duty upon the insurance company. So I would assume that, much like the underlying policy, when it delivers the umbrella, it would simply include the one-page notice, and it would, again, alert the consumer at that point to say, if you want to purchase UIM, you can purchase UIM.
And so I want to make sure I understand.
Sure.
The consumer, the insured, purchases the umbrella policy. The policy is sent to the insured. There's a notice in that policy, and you're saying you think that the insured would call up the agent, whatever her name is, and say, oh, I forgot UIM. Would you add that to the policy? How much more do I owe you? Is that the scenario?
Sure. And if you look at the notice is attached to the underlying policy. It just provides a brief description of the coverage. It basically tells them that if you don't carry UIM coverage, this message is especially important to you. It's how it works, and if you have questions about it or you want to add it, contact American Family. We'll be happy to answer your questions. It's just letting the consumer know that these are your rights. This is what you can purchase under the policy. And as we talked about, these were people who did the right thing. They purchased good insurance. They purchased insurance that covered them for catastrophic losses. The expectations were to cover everything, but they weren't provided the notice. Give them the opportunity now. Give them the notice. Let them make the decision. That's what this case boils down to.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you
both counsel for an excellent argument on underinsurance motorist coverage. And that concludes our hearing in this case. It concludes our hearings for the day. But we start again tomorrow at 9:45. And the court will meet in conference at 3:25 precisely, in closed conference. And we are in recess until 9:45. Thank you.